Thank you guys for coming and staying inside now that the sun has come out. I thought for sure everybody would flee. And thank you for coming to the panel. I apologize in advance that I do sound like a croaky frog, but this is as good as it gets, and these guys, thankfully, are going to be doing a lot more talking than I am. So thank God for small favors. Thank you for coming to Designing Positive Daily Addictions. I'm Gigi Peterkin, and I'm Vice President of Digital Health at Edelman, and very happy to have such great partners on this panel. We certainly know, and the data bears out, and if there's nothing that PR people love more, it's data, because our clients love it so much. So we know that 90% of people, according to our friends at Pew, are online looking for health information on a fairly regular basis. Yet 20% are going online consistently to actually manage their health. So why is there a disparity? And even more, when I come down with a cold like this and I realize I am complete crap at taking vitamins every day, let alone going online to track my health, yet I'm totally obsessed with updating my Facebook status and tweeting about 20 and 30 times a day, there's obviously some sort of benefit that I'm deriving from that, even though my health is suffering. So how do we take those same types of incentives and these different things that are incentivizing me to go online and update Facebook and apply it to a healthcare model? And that's some of what we're going to be talking about today. So I'm just going to go down the line, and I'm going to turn it over to these guys to do their intros and to just jump right in. But I'm joined by David Rose from Vitality, Inc. and MIT, Steve Mankey from Body Media, and Tom Nolan from Humana. And I'm going to do a really quick disconnect because David's got an awesome presentation that only a Mac would do justice to. So I'm going to let David talk a little bit about who he is and why he's here. And we thought we would sort of structure this in the data that's driving us to knowing that this is definitely a space we should all be looking at and playing in and incentivizing. So now that we've talked a little bit about the data for the fact that people do go online for health, yet there's such a low percentage of people continually managing their health online, I wanted to talk to let David speak a little bit about, what sort of data they're unearthing at MIT and in the media lab where he works and what they're doing about that.
Thanks, Gigi. Hi, everybody. Hopefully this will be something totally different. I'm going to try to motivate this idea that you should all quit working on apps, quit working on software, and start thinking about furniture. And not be so obsessed with mobility, but be more obsessed with getting people to use things every single day, to be addicted to use things every single day. 12 years ago, I started a company called Ambient Devices. We made this orb, which was like a grapefruit-sized, frosted glass, beautiful object that glowed different colors based on online data feeds. So if you were really obsessive, you could track things like the stock market. You could track pollen count if you suffer from asthma, wind speed if you're a big sailor, first derivative of barometric pressure, which is whether the fish are biting or not, or if your garden is too dry and needs watering. And what we found, sort of the surprising thing, we were interested in doing this because we thought, oh, it's going to be nice to have data sort of in your peripheral vision. It'll be calm. It'll be something you can sort of tune into when you have an extra 250 milliseconds to glance at it. And what we found, it was a really surprising result, is that having data in your peripheral vision that you glance at multiple times per hour turns out to really change people's behavior. It made diabetics take better care of themselves if they tracked their blood sugar readings on an orb. It made people walk more if they put steps on the orb. And I think it worked for a couple of reasons. But one of the things I learned was that creating a brand new object in people's lives is hard. And I really believe today, 10 years later, that piggybacking off of an existing object like Frodo's sword that showed where orcs were nearby. You know, Frodo didn't need an orb. He just needed a sword with enchantment in the sword. And sort of inspired by Frodo, we did an umbrella that shows whether the rain is due, which we needed over the last couple of days. In the Tangible Media Group, where I work at the Media Lab, we have a metaphor that we use to think about this stuff called digital shadows, which is take ordinary things in our lives and add some data layer to the top of those things to make them, to give it another layer of meaning. So, for example, this is a clock we worked with Google on that didn't launch at Ambient. where we took an ordinary clock and then wrapped your schedule around the perimeter. So you could see you have a 9 o'clock meeting and you have a half an hour to get there based on drive time, wherever the meeting is. The dots represent the way to go. But it just ends up being something that you use more often. We also worked on a bus stop for next bus that would sort of ease the pain and anxiety of waiting without knowing, which was like my cab this morning. And we had somebody in North Carolina who owned a bank called Trulian say, making data public is so powerful that he wants to put his real-time customer support index, where people are polled after every customer interaction or 20% of the customer interactions, on an obelisk outside the bank. So the color would show in real time what the sort of customer satisfaction with the bank was. And you bet that this changed people's behavior, not only, I think, mostly the employees. And something that no one in the world has seen before is Ambient Devices, which I left 5 years ago to start this next company I'll talk about in a sec, just came out with this new device, which I think is a really interesting pairing of it's an orb that tracks real-time energy use, but also if you lift it up, it has the details. So I feel like there's a really interesting design principle here, which is ambience should be parasitic on other objects that we're more accustomed to accepting in our lives. I mean, this I see as sort of ugly, and who would want that on their counter? I would rather have this. But I think in order to sell these things, you sort of have to pair the buggy whips with the new. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I became really interested in medication adherence and thought about other packaging solutions that either get us to buy more brushes or blades, and noticed that there were 3.5 billion amber pill vials that are distributed in the U.S. alone every year, which is sort of sad. We ended up inventing this little product called the Glow Cap, which used AT&T's network to connect the data from whether you opened the cap or not to the cellular network through this nightlight. Thank you, AT&T. And through a variety of incentives, we were able to change people's behavior to taking their meds about 70% of the time to over 90% of the time. And this is being used now by about 10 large pharma companies and some insurance companies, and a very large bank just rolled it out last week in order to save healthcare costs. But, I mean, this is the enchanted object with a business model, which is no one should have to pay for smart medication packaging. You know, if Novartis makes 30% more revenue, you can bet they're going to give it away, just like seatbelts are embedded in cars for they're not an option anymore. But just to give you a sense of the data, this is a snapshot of people and days, and green means they opened the cap and red means they didn't that day. And this is what the data looks like if you just give away caps that are inert, that do nothing except for gather data. And this is a picture of, so this is the control group, and this is a picture of what it looks like when we turn on the incentives. And I'll talk about the incentives in a second, but we radically change how often people take medications. The little dots are when we actually text someone or call them so they don't forget, or so they still forget, but they just don't take it.
This is the network.
This is an AT&T ad that I wanted to show you, which I'm excited about. It's airing nationally.
Video games are not confined to screens. In here, medicine talks to you.
And dogs never get lost.
It's
going to be great.
It's the AT&T network, and what's possible in here is almost impossible to say.
But they're more pill caps than dogs, I think, so we're good. So why does this work? What are the incentives? How do we design these things into objects or services that you guys are using? Well, a couple of design principles. One is, you know, fast feedback loops. It doesn't do any good to tell my 3-year-old, like, a day after he's done something that I don't want him to do, like, oh, do you remember yesterday you did the thing, and don't do that again? Like, the feedback loops has to be immediate, like dog training. And I'm sort of surprised that this company called O-Power works, where they put on your energy bill whether you suck compared to your neighbors, because it's every 30 days. Like, come on. Like, does anybody actually respond to incentives that are only provided with so much delay in the feedback loop? So fast feedback loops is good. Let me turn the sound off. So that's important in terms of the pill cap of giving you light and sound and something subtle that you can live with every day. There's a guy named Christakis who wrote a great book called Connected, and he had this wonderful metaphor in a talk that I recently heard. He said, getting one person to change their behavior is sort of like asking one buffalo in the herd of charging buffalo, like, why are you heading in that direction? Which I love. It's like, what do you mean, why am I heading in this direction? We are heading in this direction. Like, this is not a choice that I am making. And I think so many, the bold statement is, if you're designing a system that is only trying to incentivize one person at a time to change, you will fail. You have to address the surround, their network, and the other people who are influencing them. Social is another big one. So we send an email every week to you and to a loved one about whether you did open the cap or didn't open the cap. And those are very persuasive. People say that's more persuasive than anything else. So that's sort of like the buffalo. And we also share data with your doctor, which motivates a certain personality type. And we also put a button on the bottom of the cap that automatically connects to the pharmacy and orders refills. So we're trying to sort of address many of the reasons why people don't adhere. And the metaphor that I'd like for you to remember about this is these incentives need to be structured as a chord is structured in music. It's much less useful to just remind people or just provide a social incentive or just provide a coordination incentive or just provide a sentinel effect. Do you see what I mean? If you apply these things in parallel, it's like the reason that I still love my wife. It's not just one thing. You know, I won't go into that. So think of incentive systems as chords that are applied in combination. We worked on a framework to try to understand how to probe for these areas of vulnerability and sensitivity that could be applied, where you could apply multiple incentives in parallel. And you probably can't read this, but I'm happy to send it to you afterwards. But it has to do with sort of extrinsic, intrinsic, situational things and personality style things that are more durable. And all of these align around individual things you can do to motivate certain behaviors. And I think this is portable across a bunch of different behavioral change things. I just want to get to furniture. Vitality is now expanding this set of sensors as an ecosystem. I'm really interested in this idea of data shadows that are built into everyday things that we have around us, like salt shakers that might look at the table, use a Pico projector and a mechanical Turk system to analyze the data in real time and reproject data about your food, where it came from, whether it's healthy, just adjacent to the food using Pico projection. Because I think getting people to write down what they eat is a failure. So what I've been doing recently at the Media Lab are six prototypes that attempt to embed information in furniture in some sort of elegant way. And I just want to ask the question, why are you guys all so thrilled about your portable devices? You know, like, I'm a camper. Like, I sit on those things in the woods and those things at home, and I would never sit on one of the blue things at home. And I would never want to cook for friends on one of those, and I would never want to cut my veggies with one of those. Neither would you. So stop being so thrilled with your phone. So start being thrilled with furniture. So furniture is the infrastructure for activity, for human activity. It's the things that we touch every day. We're designing daily addictions. Let's get into people's gesture stream of the cabinets that they open and the drawers that they open and the things that we recline in, and embed apps in interesting ways into those existing canonical furniture forms. I've been doing this sort of hi. Thanks for coming. I've been trying to put each furniture form on the psychoanalytic couch and have it talk to me and say, cabinetry, like, what are you really about? Like, like people think you're about storage, but what are you really about? And the cabinet says, I'm about revealing things, and I'm about surprise, and I'm about discovery, and I always wanted to be an ice skater. And so I think about those sort of higher level attributes and try to map things on. So a couple of things. There's a Skype cabinet that's built for really an optimized experience around putting the camera at the eye level of the person who's using it. People come in different heights. By putting the camera behind a half-silvered mirror so you can look directly into someone's eyes if they're late. I'm just kidding. which you don't get in the Skype forehead experience. And also putting better, he's not very well lit, but putting lighting on the door so it's sort of a perfect box light. And deploying these things in pairs, because a lot of us actually have very few people we want to Skype with every day. You know, these are like my kids and my parents, and the more the merrier, and just don't spill juice on my laptop. So coffee tables are another one of these sort of things that are around most of our living rooms. We embedded a microphone in this one and disguise screens underneath, so you have photos of people and places that sort of come up out of the koi pond of your coffee table when you mention them to complement the conversation. So in this case, the enchanted object can have better resolution and also be more durable to things like spilled milk. A chair which maps your angle of repose to a Pandora station to give you more relaxation as you recline. And the nice thing about that is you just don't have to teach people how to use it, right? You just say, sit in the chair. Like, that's a manual I want to write. And this is back to clocks. I'm really interested in clocks because we think of them differently than we think of iPhones. Like, we have many, many of them. They went from towers to wrists to everything, and I think data will go the same way. So this is mapping energy consumption, which no one understands the units for, right? Kilojoules, but everyone understands the idea of hours. And if you can show them whether they're ahead of themselves or behind themselves in their own energy consumption budget, they don't even have to understand that sentence. They can just see, like, oh, it's red or it's green and it's a lot or it's a little. But that gives people a sense of norming to themselves, which I think is a good recipe for changing behavior. And this offers glanceability. You could do a smartphone app that does the same thing, but no one will ever use it. Like, that's the problem with many, many of these health smartphone apps is just gaining adoption and use. And the last one is, or second to last one, is what? This is the last one. Okay. This is an audio-only doorbell that plays cute chimes as people approach the home, and it's much simpler than apps. So thanks very much.
So as you've guessed, to work at MIT, you need to be a star. So David sort of stepped through 1, 2, and 3 of our panel all at once, which is great. But I am going to give a nod to Steve, who's challenged by my ancient laptop. That none of us like, at least of all me. To actually turn a little bit of what David's just said on his head. So Steve from Body Media, they actually do produce mobile apps that people use, and I know that David uses it too. Shh, don't tell anybody. And, you know, I think we're sort of obsessed in this culture now with millennials, you know, we sort of see the millennial generation is online, we need to target them. Oh, wait, the boomers are getting more online, and they're the ones who need to manage their health, be it their wellness or their illness, and this is sort of where the target's looking. Well, at Body Media, their targets are, you know, the new moms, the 30-somethings to 40-somethings, and in fact, you know, Steve, you can talk a little bit about your model of Jennifer and how you guys really target them, and then give us a demo for what you're doing right now.
Yeah, first, hi, you're welcome. Thank you. And first of all, how many people know of Body Media? I would like to see a raise of hands. Wow, okay, good. Every time I go to a conference, I try to see it grows in hands and hands every time, so that's always encouraging. For those of you... Maybe I'll have to slouch. I don't know.
We won't tell your kids.
Let me try that. Slouch. Can you hear me now? Now? All right, sorry, it's a little... Low.
Low.
a little problem. Everybody says it's great to be tall, but there's a few disadvantages. I say buying shoes and fitting in cars, and now I'm going to add microphones. So give a little bit of story of Body Media, a wearable device company that you wear on your arm. I have one right here. It has multi-sensor technology that tracks how many calories you burn, steps you take, and physical activity. And we're the highest, most accurate device in the field because of our multi-sensor technology. We actually gather more than 5,000 data points a minute from the body, from four different sensors: galvanic skin response, accelerometer, skin temperature, and heat flux. Those combined give us this high accuracy. I'm going to tell a little bit of story about addiction to data. So when we first launched quite a while ago, there was no such thing as smartphones. There was no such thing as iPads. We just had websites. So when we first launched, we provided all this data to the users, and we found that they were uploading and viewing their data up to 10 to 20 times a day. These are people taking out their time, going to their computer, which is not that convenient, plugging in a device, looking at the site, and seeing that data. As I mentioned, smartphones weren't available at the time, so we actually developed our own device to actually provide that information in real time. So our users were essentially asking for that by their actions, not telling us actually in words, but actually by monitoring their actions, we could determine that they really strive to have this information real time and 24/7.
It was a watch, right?
Yeah, it was a watch. I didn't bring mine because I wasn't prepared to come today, honestly. I'm a sub. So it was a watch, and you could view the information in real time wirelessly through a proprietary protocol. But what we found is, what do you know? The uploads per day went down because they didn't need to. They saw it on their wrist. And also we saw that we had more success with the weight loss for our users. Well, then smartphones came along to maybe Dave's chagrin. And then we were able to integrate through smartphones. So we were actually the first device that actually integrated with Bluetooth technology, both the iPhone and Android platforms. So you can now see your information in real time right on your phone. And what that allows is a better interaction and richness of data. So not only do you get your energy expenditure, which you could have gotten in your wrist, but you actually can marry that with other information that the person is logging in, so their food log. So you can make decisions right then and there. As Dave mentioned, you want to be really quick feedback loops to be actionable. Well, if you're logging your food and you're comparing how much have you eaten so far today, and you can see how many calories you've burned so far today and compare those goals, you know what you can do. Maybe you can have that cookie for dessert, or maybe not, or maybe you got to work out a little bit longer. So what we found is really by looking at our users' demographics that they really wanted this real-time interaction. Because of technology, like iPhones are quite difficult to demo on a mobile screen, so I'm just going to show you a quick overview of our data through our website. As you can see, we track calories burned, but
that's what happens when you drive somebody else's
computer.
A little dim.
But we get down to the minute granularity of data. When we first launched our program, actually, we didn't have this level of information. And this is something actually our users use their voices to ask for. They begged for this information. And once they got it, they love it. Because then what it allows you to see is your activities through the day and where your activities work best for you. Sometimes people are surprised that maybe that walk to work is helping me out, or playing with my kids on the weekend is really where I burn my calories. If I just change those activities by and encourage them and do them more often, I actually be more successful with my weight loss. You see here, unfortunately, sleep is a major component of weight loss. And you see, maybe South by Southwest hasn't been too kind to me. I only have 3 hours and 45 minutes. It's probably why my voice is a little froggy. I'm a little tired today, but I had a good time last night for sure. but definitely something that's important to track long-term trends, because actually I can speak to it for now. I'm actually quite hungry. As you if you don't sleep enough, actually it affects your hormones, which actually make you more hungry throughout the day. I'm definitely starving right now from the lack of sleep. But it's important to know those differences and track those over time and try to improve those. I think that is all I have for the demo for the really high level. But I think the important thing is here is the data and the users really want to see this every day and every minute. And bring it to mobile devices, really make it palatable to users so they can make that decision right then and there. But what we've done is actually taken that to the next step. Is not just data, is actually interpreting that data for the user, because a sea of data, it can be confusing. How much are you going to look at? What are you going to do? So we actually started to use our analytics in the back end to determine what the person is going to do in the future. So you can see here in this graph, it's actually predicting what I'm going to do for the rest of the day. And it's actually predicting based on my past history, my past data. It's personalized to me, not everybody else, specifically to my data and what I've done before. into saying, hey, I'm going to be 297 calories short of my goal today. I better do something about that. Now I can go to my mobile phone. I can plug in a workout and say, I'm going to actually go for a 297-calorie workout and actually track that progress as I work out. Not how many minutes, not how many miles, but actually how many calories I'm going to burn and track the most actionable thing. That's the result I want to get.
That's so geeky.
Yeah, it is. I'm so a geek. Cool. Yeah, I'm a marketing really? Guy.
Like how much of the – how would you say your primary adopters are – people like you?
No, actually not. It's actually quite surprising. When I meant to data being addictive, it's not the quantified self folks who are really using our site. It's really just average people trying to lose weight. Our demographics are typically women or 35 to 40.
So why don't you try to abstract it a little bit more and make it less data rich?
Well, we do plan on doing that, but we actually plan on doing it through partnerships. So that's one reason we're at South by Southwest. We're at the Mashread booth. Showing our data API. So we want to actually encourage third-party developers to add that enrichment to the data, do the gamification, do the incentive programs. And actually we talk to insurance companies and corporate wellness companies all the time trying to get them to use that as an incentive program and integrate our data into that. We as Body Media don't have the bandwidth nor necessarily the skill sets in every area to kind of make it as palatable. So we are really looking through our APIs to drive that home. So,
that's great.
And then before we get to Tom, though, just to tap on what David was saying, to get to that true level of addiction, do you envision that you're going to stay on a mobile platform, or are you experimenting with sort of plugging into those everyday objects and making them more enchanted?
Well, yes and no. We have a little bit. We think there's all aspects of it. So our current user base, believe it or not, is 30% mobile, 70% still on the web, so not completely mobile. But we do believe
That's such a strange piece of data. Like, aren't we all everything?
Yeah, it's
isn't there
it's
a
very
view?
Zen.
No, I mean, there should be a view of the data that's ambient, and a view that's on your mobile, and another view that's on the web, and like just with different data richness. And
right? Exactly, and that's part of it. We want to build an ecosystem where you can view this information. So you can view it on your smartphone. You can actually view it on your mobile. We actually have a partnership with Panasonic using our APIs. So you can view your information right on your IPTV enabled TV.
You're going to go back to a watch.
That's Humana's approach as well. And you'd see, we've already had a chance to talk together, and you'll see in a minute. I have a few slides, just a very few. It's meeting people where they are is what it's all about. So I don't know if that should be the segue for me to go up. You're going to drive for me, right?
I'm going to drive for
okay,
you.
Okay, awesome. So. Thank you.
Thanks.
So I think I'll start by saying that some of these slides are going to be sort of from a macro standpoint. I mean, really what I'm about to describe is what David and all of us are up against, and that is a system that's not really a system. So go ahead, Gigi. I'll tell you when to move. So the state of healthcare, what is it? Rising costs. I'll go quickly. Everybody knows this, but it's really shocking. It's appalling. We spend $2 trillion a year just in this country on healthcare, and our results are in the middle, if not below the middle, of not just industrialized countries, but in a lot of cases, even non-industrialized countries. Next up, a lot of waste. There are some analysts who actually say that $1 trillion out of the $2 trillion is wasted, shouldn't be spent. Next. Rising obesity is an epidemic. 2/3 of Americans are clinically obese or overweight. That's only going up. Next. What happens because of that? All these following terrible things. Rising hypertension. Next. Diabetes, which of course leads to all kinds of terrible, some cases life-threatening, certainly life-diminishing conditions. And essentially a health economy that cannot be sustained. We can't continue to keep raising costs over time. That's why Dave and Steve are doing the stuff that they're doing. That's why so many of you have enough interest to come here with your companies to try to solve this problem. And again, I may have mentioned this at the beginning. People talk about our healthcare system. It's not a system. It's not. It doesn't have any of the characteristics of a system. It's not organized. It's not efficient. It doesn't have any sort of rationale behind it. So again, that's what we're all up against. So now, just for a couple of minutes, I'll talk about what Humana is trying to do to ameliorate all that. Next up. We say that if we can find a way to make healthy things fun and fun things healthy, then we can design positive addictions. At least that's our starting point. And here's some examples. We have a dream of lifelong well-being. There's the fun things healthy and healthy things fun, a consumer-centric approach, a retail approach, really. You tend to think of insurance companies, and that's what we are traditionally, as having a sort of B2B approach. We sell our products to big companies or small companies. More and more we're selling to individuals one-to-one. Next, we have an innovation center. I'd like, please, for Shankar Ram to raise his hand. Shankar, after the panel, some of you guys might want to get with Shankar. He is the head of our innovation center. It's an actual physical location in our headquarters building in Louisville, Kentucky. Has lots of neat stuff going on, and Shankar is the expert. Next up. Now, you've already heard about Vitality. There's actually Humana Vitality, and this is a rewards and incentive program that's just beginning. It comes from a South African company that some of you may have heard of called Discovery. They've had a whole lot of success in South Africa designing positive addictions through rewards and incentives. I won't take you through this whole thing.
This means the acquisition went through?
Yeah, that's right. But by far the most interesting part of this, because it's the easiest to remember, is this Vitality Age up here in the upper right-hand corner. I will not confess to you what my Vitality Age is, but it's shockingly greater than my chronological age, and it's based objectively on biometric screenings that I submitted to, and then they said, guess what? You're not actually X, you're Y, and the Y was a whole lot. And it's supposed to scare you, and it does. Then you design a personal pathway to do something about that, and as a result, you get rewards. And the rewards are also customized. The personal pathway to better health is customized, so are the rewards. Those of you who like to spend get movie tickets. Those of you who like to save, you collect your Vitality points, you end up with a trip to Paris. It's that kind of thing, and it's working so far. Next up. Mobile, I'll just spend a couple of minutes on this. These guys know this inside out, so do a lot of you. Next up. This is our, essentially, if you're a Humana Health Insurance member, you can now function completely through your phone. You've got the thing on the left is your spending account. A lot of people who have high deductible health plans also have health savings accounts. Many of you have these. These are tax advantage plans. You can save money doing them, and this tells you what your status is. The Humana card is also a debit card. It's soon to be a smart card. And then on the right, there's all of your personal information, plus there's lots of other capabilities on this, like how to find a doctor nearby and nearest hospital and whatnot. Next up. We are also creating a virtual and an actual community of people who really like to work out and like to measure and keep track of their activity as they work out, and they like to connect with other people who either cycle or walk or run, and that's what Humana Fit is all about. Next up. Humana Gear, I'm a living example. This is just a pedometer. But I can tell you it changes behavior. I mean, I keep track of my steps, and I care about my steps in a way that just didn't matter to me before. So what does it mean as a practical matter? I'll take the stairs rather than the elevator. When I go home, I do not want to look at this thing and find some number like 2,871. That's lame. You know, in the old days, it didn't matter to me, and so it's made a real practical difference in terms of how I approach just minute by minute living, walking versus sitting, or walking versus taking the elevator. Next up. We have something called the Well-Being Tour. It may be coming to your city soon, which includes something that's really fun, a smoothie bike. You guys ever been on a smoothie bike? It's just fun. You pedal and pedal and pedal, and lo and behold, by the end, you've got a smoothie that you just drink then and there. Real-time feedback. It's cool. It's great stuff. There's a hydration station. You do the same thing making water to drink. And there's also biometric screenings at this mobile 18-wheeler that goes all around the country. Almost done. Next up. Right in the back is a game that's the result of a partnership we have with Ubisoft. It's Your Shape Fitness Evolve 2012, and we have a couple of willing folks around here. Eric and Wagner, raise your hands, please. When the panel's over, or maybe during the panel, there they are, they'll demo it. And if Gigi is so inclined, she might ask some of you to demo it. It's sort of a Wii-based deal. It's fun. It's working. And again, making healthy things fun, fun things healthy. So next, I think that's the end of it. That's the end of it. So with that, we want to leave plenty of time for questions, so I'll pause and stop. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Yeah, and I do... there is a break between this panel and the next, but even while we're doing questions and talking just about... I do want to sort of touch on the future a little bit as well. If anybody wants to go in the back and demo the game, I actually saw it demoed a few weeks ago in Philadelphia, and it's really cool. So don't miss out on that. Do we have any questions from the audience before I hit these guys with any more questions? Do you guys just want to come up? Yeah, that would be great. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you. This was really fascinating. So great to see all this in one piece. I have a question specifically for David regarding the whole furniture approach, which... find absolutely fascinating. Of course, there's a number of challenges in go-to-market, as we know very well. And in that particular case, I'm wondering, like, if there might be an entrance, you know, to accelerate the adoption, you know, in the office space before the home space.
Yeah, I think even though I positioned a lot of these things as sort of objects for the home, I feel like companies like Vitra and Steelcase... who are doing office environments or hospitals or airports, Actually, if there's anybody in the audience that has works for a company that wants to use one of these prototypes in the context of a company, we'd love to deploy some, like a dozen chairs that sort of help people mellow out during the day, or you know, brainstorming tables that automatically are listening to the conversation and trying to propose photos that will sort of get you non-laterally thinking. I think because of the price points, we'll probably enter there first. Yeah. Thanks.
But that actually reminds me, though, so Body Media, you guys are actually looking at the connected home. So you're hitting the home first. Can you just talk a little bit about that other side of the coin?
Yeah, I mean, one thing we think it's going to be important is using health devices beyond just as a health device. So as you saw, we can track how much sleep you get, which I didn't get much of last night. But if you have a connected home, it can actually detect that you're about to go to sleep. Well, what could it do there? Well, it could turn down your humidistat. It could turn down your thermometer. It could turn on your security system, turn off your lights in your house and turn on, you know, the lights in the security system. So I think that's one way where you can integrate health devices and get it be used and engaged in a different way, but still mm-hmm. engage people in constantly monitoring their body and then yeah. looking at data in other ways.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question?
Yeah.
And then Emma. Yeah. You said you're doing a Galvanic Skin Response, but it doesn't seem like stress level is one of your inputs. And it seems like, at least for my own behavior, like if there's anything that cascades into lack of sleep or overeating, it's stress.
Yeah.
So like, doesn't that seems like a good correlation to draw?
Yeah, we're always working on new algorithms, and the guys are in back home are definitely working on algorithms around stress. There's a challenge with Galvanic Skin Response when it's other than on your fingers, because the nerve endings, there's not as much sensitivity to that signal. Hmm. When you're operating, we can detect some things, but it's not quite as sensitive as you have an EKG, you know, like a lie detector where they have it on your fingers.
Right.
And does that game in the back, does that also aim at stress as well as fitness?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely is a stress reducer because it's fun. Again, I mean, it's hard to argue against the premise, if you will, that having fun reduces stress. I think that's a universal. I think we all agree with that. It's something people want to do, and it's a fun game. You'll see if you demo it.
It's a really fun game. We have a question over here.
So quick comment, I played my first body meter device in 2004. I'm a fan, and I think I'm also one of the few people who's ever collected sensor data using body media for people having sex. It was a fun project. But the question is, how does
everyone can hear?
How does this become mainstream? Because there's people like, you know, the data people or the quantified side person, whatever. We've been using these devices in these sort of hidden communities where they're extremely popular, and body meter is a great sensor that people use. For years, and when does this become something that everybody else is becoming a mainstream device that we have?
I have an answer to that. Before you go, I think. Well, I mean, obviously, if you have a business model that supports giving it away or legislating it as something that becomes a standard of care, I think those are two ways that you completely sidestep the high cost of customer adoption. What are you guys seeing in terms of customer adoption costs per person right now?
I don't know if I actually have that number, to be honest, but I
make something up.
But yeah,
is it like $30 or $200 or like what is the marketing budget divided by a number of people?
I don't know those numbers, and I couldn't give you if I could, because being a private company, we don't usually give out the kind of information.
I didn't think so.
This is the challenge of having a researcher on
the panel. Two tries. But I think there's two things we're looking to approach that. Is one is actually through corporate wellness integration, because we believe that's one way to drive it into, you know, cost savings for an organization, and they're willing to pay for it for the end user, right? Mm-hmm. If we have outcome studies that can prove that you can lose three times as much more weight if you use our device versus not in a weight loss program. So we think that's, you know, obviously the improvement of healthcare from just weight loss alone is huge. So we think we can encourage corporations to pay for devices that way. We're actually working on a new model, too, that's actually a different cost point to get into corporate wellness and to trial. We have a partnership with a company called Avery Dennison Medical Solutions. To wear a disposable patch. Essentially, think of it as a Band-Aid with electronics built into it. Okay, you wear on your arm for 7 days. So those 7 days, you can get a taste of that data. Because we, as you know, once you try it, you get addicted to that data. So if we can get devices at lower cost points for trial, we think that people get addicted and upsell into full-time wear.
Mm-hmm. Can I just make one more comment? I know there's lots of questions. Just be brief. There's an aspect of data. We've basically been talking about individualized data, which is extremely important, the feedback that you get when you wear the patch, but there's also the idea of data as it relates to population health. And here's where I'm just going to take the blame for the entire insurance industry, where, you know, we've had mountains and mounds of data literally for decades that we've done virtually nothing with that's useful to anybody except maybe us. And I say maybe, us. And now, just at the beginning, we're starting to make that data usable in such a way that we can actually demonstrate improvements in population health over time. Just a brief example for Humana, we acquired a company just last year called Anvita Health, which essentially aggregates data signals having come from a variety of sources. It might be claims data, it might be a doctor visit. It puts these all together and it says, aha, Sally Jones is at risk of a heart attack, and it's a fairly small amount of time. It can be fairly precise about in the next 60 days, you should talk to her. And so then we can. And then you multiply that times millions of people. Humana insures 17 million people. You start getting real progress in population health as well as individual health.
Right here.
Hi, my name's Daniel. I work at Huntington Memorial Hospital in Pasadena. I find the idea of all these devices and all these technologies really interesting in terms of addressing how to change behaviors. But in all of these cases, it strikes me that there is cost involved. And with regard to that, there's a lot of the population that is not going to feasibly be able to afford these sorts of things in their home. You know, they're not going to have a connected home. They may not be able to buy this sort of furniture. In some cases, they may not even have smartphones. And when you look at public health data, a great majority of the population that makes up these people that have chronic issues with obesity and with diabetes, and cardiovascular health issues. How can we bridge some of those behavioral patterns and changing those within that population that really can't afford these sort of technological advances, whose maybe day-to-day existence is just trying to get by day-to-day?
I see these as very cheap compared to other things that are standard of care today. So things like call centers where real people spend half an hour on the phone with you talking about your diabetes is, like, how much does that cost? $70, $35, something like that for that half-hour call? Like, we're deploying GloCaps, and pharma companies and insurers are giving these away, and we charge them about $10 per month for everything. That includes the hardware, it includes what we have to pay to AT&T, it includes emails and text messages and printed reports. So I see that as a... And these are consumer electronics and web services. And web services, as you know, scale to cost nothing after you get them built, if you're rolling them out to large populations. And consumer electronics have a similarly downward curve.
I'll just say one more thing, too. There actually is a low-tech aspect to what you're asking, and it gets around the whole cost issue as well as a high-tech. A couple of Humana examples, we have these places called guidance centers that are pitched to our senior members. These are just places to go. They're community centers. They're no charge to go there. But once they get there, they can socially interact with their peers. They can play games like this one over here, all for nothing. And they improve their health that way, and it doesn't cost anything. So it isn't just a high-tech. And I also want to support my colleagues. Some of the stuff that they got going on isn't that expensive, relatively speaking, anyway.
In the center? No. I promised him next. Sorry. Thanks.
So I think the GloCaps is great because it obviously gets put into your home and you get to use it. But a lot of it...
Given to you by your pharmacist.
Yeah. But a lot of the ideas that I've heard in this space are usually attract, like Bet Body Media, the more enlightened consumer or the more early adopter consumer. And I think that a lot of those folks, almost to a certain extent, are already advantaged because they're thinking about it. And so how do we actually attack the broader problem that, you know, we have this inundation of calories, of sugar, of just unhealthy food, of bad behavior, nobody exercising. How do we make things less bad first? I mean, it's almost like a, yeah, how do we combat the onslaught?
We're all going to look at each other for a second now and say, oh, you want to take that one?
This one's not Humana's fault, by the way. But education is a lot of it. And also, you know, frankly, to sort of pick up on a huge theme of South by Southwest, just sort of entrepreneurism in general, you know, the people who have the guts, and I'll take Louisville as an example, our home city, it's just beginning to happen, to put up a grocery store in the inner city that sells products that are healthy, all right? I mean, a lot of times it just comes down to sort of fiscal and human bravery to get around this stuff. And it's amazing. This won't surprise you. But and there's nothing against people in the inner city, because I think you're right. It's generally true of everybody. But, you know, people in the inner city, when they go in stores like this and they go, oh, my gosh, I can still have food that tastes good, and I get it now in a way that I never would have if Joe here or Sally hadn't established this grocery store on 3rd Street. So well, that's a big part of it, I think.
Yeah. And then we'll go over there.
Hi. This is a really amazing talk. It's really beautiful to see everything that's going on, all the collaboration, the partnerships. This is actually maybe a good follow-up to that question regarding education. So, Tom, in terms of corporate wellness programs, maybe specifically with Humana, I feel a big barrier of behavior change is having the education to know what we should eat, how we should exercise, how it affects us, all that information and knowledge, combined with the metrics that you're providing through body media and the accountability that helps us do that together. I'm wondering from the education aspect, what are you guys looking into as far as ways to get that information to your employees, whether it's bringing speakers in, PowerPoint programs, and how much have you looked into potentially virtual learning, virtual classrooms, beaming maybe experts in from around the world to help educate your employees and other partnerships?
That's a really great question. I'll give you two answers. First of all, I'll tell you what doesn't work, and that is calling any programs of that kind by the word wellness. Wellness is done. I don't care how good the program is. It's just a non-starter. There's no real good replacement for it. There's nothing wrong with the substance of wellness at all. But there's everything wrong with, well, you know, oh, another wellness seminar, oh, brother. Well-being, we found, works a little better, get a little traction behind that. We are, by the way, doing some distance learning stuff already, not nearly enough, and we should do more, and we will do more. And it's been well-received, but maybe this is a challenge for everybody in this room. You know, what's the word we can use to get people motivated that isn't wellness? It's just dead, because so much of wellness from the 1990s and 80s and even the 2000s just didn't work.
And actually, before we're going to go over there, the other thing that I've noticed is there's a little bit of a swell of patient panels here. So to get back to that earlier point about the engaged patient, I think we also need to see some more partnerships between companies and patients who are already engaged, because so many of them are just people like us. They've just taken that step to learn and then to act. And there's no better ambassador for making a sea change than somebody you can relate to who's already done it and has done it successfully. So I think that's another part of the education component that's really been lacking is mobilizing the folks who are already doing it and who already might believe in a brand or an approach or a system, and giving them a platform to maybe reach a broader audience.
Well, one thing I was going to add too at Body Media, one thing we're looking at too is actually using the data to determine when to feed the educational component. Giving people a bunch of education up front, read it, that's pretty boring. It's just too much. So if you send it to them in pieces, especially when those pieces are relevant to their current data state, then it's more knowledgeable to them. They can learn right then and there instead of just looking, trying to read a book or a magazine or a newsletter.
Yeah, all at once. We have a question over there.
Just coming from the kind of big E education perspective on this. A lot of the examples, at least we walked through here, were about changing behaviors of adults. I'm wondering if any of you have looked at how your strategies could work at changing the health behaviors of younger people. Given the obesity and diabetes problems we see, given that at early stages, teens and tweens, you could be setting behaviors for life, and particularly on the device front, the device that I see most available and attached to a 13-year-old is a mobile device. Right. But anyway, your comments on working with younger people would be interesting.
I've got a response to that. Actually, Humana had a program incredibly successful. Unfortunately, so far it's only a pilot, but we're going to expand it. And the key word, I'll cut to the chase, in terms of kids, what we found is the word competition. They love it. It is incredibly motivating. This particular program called American Horsepower Challenge, it combined computer technology with a smart pedometer with competition in such a way that every group, a classroom, let's say, had an avatar, and the avatar advanced across the board on the computer that you could keep, you know, firing up and seeing how you were doing compared to other classrooms, first of all, other schools then, second of all, and believe it or not, other congressional districts, because we did this in conjunction with 20 congressmen. And the idea of competition is what got these kids up. And now here's the great thing. So we ran the program for 20 weeks, and as you can imagine, the results were great. They took this many more steps. They lost this many more pounds, all of which we tracked very carefully. Then, though, when the program had stopped for 6 months, we went back. And lo and behold, there was a measurable, appreciable increase in continued positive activity, even though the program wasn't going on. So competition, I think, with kids really goes a long way.
Yeah. Steve or David, do you have any?
I have a cautionary tale, which is just about agency, which is, I think, certainly, I mean, this is sort of intuitive, but lots of, if it's coming from the parents, you probably have worse adoption than if it's coming from some other authority figure, or if you can use sort of starstruck celebrity incentives to, you know, when I, I'm not a kid, but when I run with my iPod and, you know, Lance Armstrong says that's the fastest mile you've ever run, I'm like, yes! so I think there's a way to use the hierarchy of role, the things that they aspire, the celebrities that they aspire to as a means of providing incentives. I had one other, I know there are a lot of questions, but just one other subtle point, which was there's a lot of talk around social incentives, like leaderboards and fame and that type of thing, versus financial incentives. And there was just a study that was done at MIT where they had three groups. One was counting steps, another one was counting steps for money, and another one was counting steps for money that was paid to someone else. So just like, wait, wait, don't tell me, it's like you're playing for, you know, your sister. But it's the nice thing about that third group, which was much more effective in terms of the more steps for less money, they were able to walk much more for, they were much more active, was it sort of coerced the financial incentive into being a social incentive because you were playing for someone else, and it just promoted more conversation about, you know, even if it was a small financial reward, still your sister would give you a hard time if she didn't get it, or thank you very much for an extra $3 that month. Yeah. So I think that's a really good recipe, is to not just jump to paying for people for things, but trying to make everything be positioned as a social incentive.
Yeah. In the back, in the green shirt. And then in the back of the green chair.
So you guys have talked a lot about kind of putting the onus of cost on industry, you know, be it Novartis paying for glow caps or being, you know, a corporate wellness program paying for, you know, the arm strap. I guess my question is, you know, if there are these compelling statistics around improved adherence or improved wellness, what are the barriers to kind of mass adoption to these things? Like, why aren't Novartis or Pfizer putting glow caps on every single, you know,
well, they
pill?
Are for medications that are more than, you know, $5 or $10 a day, because they see 30% more revenue, and it's sort of a no-brainer for them. But in that case, that it's a slow-moving industry, and they're
it takes a while.
You just have to get through this gauntlet of legal, med, regulatory,
lawyers,
and that's why it's
insane.
So slow, not because they can't see the data in real time. In fact, the sort of Google-esque AdWord, show me my AdWord conversion rate in real time, and if the engine is working, I'll pour money in, and if it's not working, I'll pour that's brand new for the pharma industry. They've never been able to have that sort of daily feedback loop of how many more, you know, how many more Diavan tabs are we selling this day? And so that creates a whole nother data set that's fascinating, because then they can see what's the impact of their direct-to-consumer advertising on adherence. What's the impact of other social media programs on adherence? It becomes like a little Nielsen box. So that's sort of a brand new, exciting thing that they're able to do.
If I could just add on to that, I actually think that it's even more fundamental as to why there hasn't been mass adoption, let's say, among employers. And that is everybody, every employer, everyone in this room knows intuitively that if you improve employee wellness, you're going to improve employee productivity. But here's what they don't know: by how much? And since these are businesses, that's how they make up their mind. In other words, if I invest $1 in the wellness of my employees, how much am I going to get back? $1.50? $2.25? No one's ever done that. That would be a great contribution to human knowledge, to be able to make a business case for wellness. So you put something specific and measurable next to what everybody knows is intuitively true.
But just don't call it wellness.
What's that?
Don't call it wellness.
Yeah, no, right. Think of something else to call it.
So thank you all for your point of view. My name's Jay. I run a sports biomechanics lab at University of Virginia, and I'm a data whore. That's what I do every day. And I think you guys touched on some interesting things, and I agree. Wellness is dead because it's something else somebody has to do. It's like, I have to do another thing. Well, I don't want to do that. And I think data is a great thing to get people kind of, wow, yeah, let me look at, you know, the fact that I burn most of my calories on weekends playing with my kids, but... And competitions hit the nail on the head for the youth folks because they don't really care about the data. They just want to kick their friend's butt. And we see this come out in all, you know, highly competitive environments. But If you look at all the research, I'm a clinician first and foremost, and all the research shows to truly make a difference, folks have to have intrinsic motivation and be motivated internally and love to do something else. So I'm curious, you know, if you guys could share any specific things that you guys have, you know, tried or failed at to try and really give internal motivation for folks to try something new, to truly change your lifestyle. And it's not just, you know, uploading data or comparing to my friend, but to change, you know, internal habits.
What's a habit you're thinking of?
Yeah, I'm just going to ask the question, like what?
Give us one of your bad habits.
Yeah, so, if you look at, you know, athletes, like the reason why people train, well, I can't imagine a day not exercising. Like, and it's the hardest burden to overcome. I think kids, if you give them an opportunity in a competitive environment, they rise to the occasion. Adults who have no history of a competitive environment, who need an environment competitive enough to challenge them, but not too much to turn them off. So I think that's, you know, if we're talking about making a big global impact on activity, which is what we really have, it's an activity problem, how do you really change someone's internal motivation to change a lifestyle?
I think I just would evoke, there's a behavioral, I guess he's a behavioralist at Stanford named BJ Fogg, and he talks a lot of, two things come to mind that he's done. One is this idea of finish lines in sight.
Yeah.
So, like, any behavior change starts with today. You know, starts with just doing one thing differently one time before you routinize that. And so I think a successful sort of recipe for a lot of behavior change programs is to get people to sort of short sprints at first. You know, just do this for 3 days. Let's just do something that's just 10 days long. And when they see that finish line in sight, it's not like committing to something for the rest of their lives, which is much harder to commit to. The other idea is, I think there's a big difference, which I don't think is really well understood, about data analysis. And BJ Fogg calls one type of persuasion hot triggers. And that's like when a buddy in front of you decides to get a salad rather than a burger, and you're like, oh, huh, I guess I'll have what he's having. Like, that's sort of an in-the-moment decision. You're mirroring whatever somebody else is doing. Or, like, you're about to buy a candy bar, and somebody says, really? Really? You're gonna eat that giant piece of chocolate right now? But that's very different than the looking at the data after a week of body media activity or after a month of sleep activity to try to really understand trends and patterns. And I think as humans, the opportunity for persuasion is with hot triggers. Like, that's why I'm interested in furniture and orbs and pill caps and other things that you just, where you can't avoid the, quote, data of, have I done this? Have I not done this? Should I take the bus right now? If it's only 3 more minutes to wait versus hailing a cab. Like, all of those things are sort of hot triggers that happen in the moment. And it's not this sort of big data visualization, data analysis thing that no one's really going to do more than maybe once or twice a month or never. Yeah. Sorry.
And I want to get to one more question. But
that's why I like the watch.
I also don't think you can underestimate the social good aspect of it, too. So we did a global study at Edelman called the Edelman Health Barometer, where we surveyed 5,000 people. And the highest motivator was knowing that what you were doing was going to benefit somebody else. So we've seen things, you know, with kids that and it also plays into the competition where, you know, they're getting their grandparents to log the steps they're taking and then using it to compete with their friends. So that's the competition aspect. But then we're also asking them to take more steps themselves as a way to sort of motivate and incent their parents and their grandparents to take better care of themselves. So while you're talking about changing an intrinsic internal behavior, if knowing that that change is going to benefit somebody else you care about, there's a much higher adoption rate, and I think we'll see people sort of going that way. We have time for one more, and the guy in the plaid shirt in the dead center has had his hand up for...
The last question will be the answer.
Oh, really? We got you? So then we'll... Right back there. Cool.
So this is kind of related, and I was wondering if you can talk about the personalization. And a lot of the things that you do with body media, I mean, I love personally the analytics and looking at those numbers. I think if you can assume that you make a benchmark and the dynamic of that data actually matters to you personally more so than to anybody else, then you perceive it in the right way. but it's like looking at the nutrition facts that says basically your diet is based on 2,000 calories per day. It means nothing to me if, you know, depending if I run 4 hours a day or if I do nothing, sit in the office. So what do you do in more practical steps to kind of educate people and make them understand what it means?
Yeah, I can answer that because it actually comes to both questions. One thing we're looking at Body Media is looking at what success looks like for people. So not looking at just metrics and say, this is, you know, what a 40-year-old man is, and this is how many calories he burns, and this is where you are. Because that's not really helpful either. It doesn't mean anything. But we're really looking at is what is success. So what is someone who's like you and who wanted to do what you wanted to do, and how do they get there, and what does that look like? Because what we find, a lot of people are not practical. We let you choose how much weight you want to lose when you first join the program. Everybody chooses 2 pounds a week. That's the max we can do, too. Well, that's pretty hard. I've done it. You're hungry all the time. So, I mean, more realistic, hey, try it 0.5 pound or 1 pound and do the sprint. So really looking at the data in a big picture and finding what that magic sauce is through the use of real data instead of just, you know, comparing it to more traditional benchmarking. Mm-hmm. Does that help answer the question?
All right, cool. Well,
yeah, it's personalizing. Well, it would be personalizing your roadmap. In this case, on weight loss, it would be applied to different technologies and different conditions, but personalizing your weight loss journey based on who you are, being a male, female, your BMI, everything about you, and tailoring a program that people have been successful that are similar to you.
Cool.
I don't know if you've tried Direct Life. It's a Philips. It's a Philips pedometer weight loss program. But it's interesting because they assign a cute person. Unfortunately, she lives like in Eindhoven, you know, Denmark or something. Because to be sort of your health coach. And even though I think it's like one person can manage, one health coach is managing 300 or 400 people. Still, you sort of have this personality that you're performing for besides yourself. And I think that sort of externalizing, like, I'm doing it for her, even though she never met me.
Yeah, and then one last thing.
And it was to stalk her.
It was alluded to a little bit earlier in this panel, and that is simply a community of people, of friends, normally, those who people you hang out with anyway. If everybody can be convinced to get on this, it's just mutually reinforcing, and that tends to work as well.
Yeah. All right, well, we're at time, and I want to give you guys some time to go. If we can start at the demo in the back, guys, that would be awesome. So we'll be here for a little bit if you have any more questions, and definitely go check that game out. It's really cool. Thanks, guys.